Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Hillman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. This is a show dedicated to empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And these days, there is nothing more important than being informed so you can find the best path, make the best choices, decisions for yourself, your family, your community. And I'm so happy you're joining me today on the show because I have another inspiring, transforming, a wake-up call conversation happening for you. And before we jump into it, if you are listening for the very first time, welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you so much for being part of this community. If you would like to get my archived shows so you can catch all of these absolutely fantastic interviews, then here are the two options. You can go to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, and like me there. I post my interviews there. I actually have two programs on Progressive Radio Network. I have this one, What Women Must Know, and I also have a program called The Love Code, which has a very definite spiritual orientation. So both of those shows get posted, or you can go to my website, which is my website is CherylSelman.com, and if you opt in there, you will be sent these shows, and there's other information that I send out on a regular basis as well. So it's all about keeping you educated and informed and expanding our knowledge. So there you go, and I'm just going to jump right into my conversation today with my guest because it's such an important conversation. We're going to be talking about the lure and the lies of processed food, nutrition, and modern medicine with Dr. Robert Lustig. And that's the subtitle of his newly released book called Metabolical, The Lure and Lies of Processed Food, Nutrition, and Modern Medicine. And I just want to say that I have been following the work and the inspiration of Dr. Robert Lustig for many, many years, and I have great respect for Dr. Lustig and his passion and his purpose in life. And I am just so delighted and thrilled that he is making some time to be with us on the show. So let me officially welcome Dr. Lustig to the show. Hello, Robert, and welcome, welcome, welcome to What Women Must Know.
Thanks very much for having me, Dr. Selman. And you can call me Rob. I am not your doctor.
And call me Cheryl. As my dad used to say, call me anything but late for dinner. So it all works for me. We're good. You have been on this path for many, many years. I probably would say decades of trying to awaken everyone, the government, the states, the public, of the problem that's going on with this obesity epidemic. So let me first give your bio to my audience. So Dr. Robert Lustig is Emeritus Professor of Pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and member of the Institute for Health Policy Studies at the University of California, San Francisco. He has authored 130 peer-reviewed articles, 80 academic chapters and reviews, and dozens of op-eds for the public. His 2009 YouTube lecture, Sugar, the Bitter Truth, has accrued 12 million viewers. He is the former chairman of the Obesity Task Force of the Pediatric Endocrine Society, a member of the Obesity Task Force of the Endocrine Society, and a member of the Pediatric Obesity Devices Committee of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. He is also the chief science officer of the nonprofit Eat Real, dedicated to reversing childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes by bringing real food into schools. He has never taken money from the food industry, so has no conflicts of interest. And his newly released book is Metabolical, The Lure and the Lies of Processed Food, Nutrition, and Modern Medicine. This is a really important conversation, so please stay tuned, listen up, because the health of you, your children, and future generations depends on getting this truth. So, you have dedicated your life to this work, working in pediatrics. You've seen it in the role of endocrinology. My first question to you, Rob, is what was the event that was a wake-up call for you about how we are going down the wrong path with all the consequences?
Oh, thank you very much for the introduction, first of all, Cheryl. I have been interested in how the brain controls hormones and how hormones control the brain since I was in seventh grade, when I did a research paper in Science on the hypothalamus. So I can't really say that was my turning point. Probably the first turning point was in 1994 with the discovery of a hormone called leptin. Leptin is a hormone that is made by your fat cells, circulates in your bloodstream, goes to your brain, and tells your brain, you know what? I've eaten enough. I have enough energy on board to engage in normal, expensive metabolic processes. I don't need to eat everything else in the refrigerator right now. I'm good. That hormone, okay, basically put obesity squarely within endocrinology. And as a neuroendocrinologist, it was, you know, it behooved me to understand that and to utilize that information. At the same time that leptin had been discovered, I was a physician at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. And we had a whole cadre of patients, of children, who had survived their brain tumors only to become massively obese. And those kids started out normal weight, then they got their tumor, then they got their surgery or their radiation, and then the weight just started accruing. But what was even more bizarre was not only was the weight accruing, but these kids lost all interest in everything. They lost interest in life. They lost interest in all of their activities. These kids became, you know, totally docile and sedentary. They sat on the couch, ate Doritos, and slept. And the parents would come to me and say, this is double jeopardy. My child survived the tumor only to succumb to, you know, one of the therapies. And it was up to me to try to do something about it. Well, so knowing that, I knew about this leptin. And I postulated way back in 1995 that these kids, because of the brain damage, because of the hypothalamic damage, because the hypothalamus controls, you know, all the hormonal secretions of the body, these kids couldn't see their leptin. And because they couldn't see their leptin, their brains thought they were starving. And because their brains thought they were starving, they ate more because they were trying to make more leptin, even though, of course, the leptin still wouldn't work. And they would also conserve. They would sit on the couch because they didn't feel like exercising because their brains thought they were starving. And when you're starving, you don't exercise because you're trying to conserve. So I was reasonably comfortable with the idea that the biochemistry might be driving the behavior. So the question was, what could I do about it? Was there anything we could do to help these kids and learn something in the process? And so what I did was I went to the literature, and I was aware of this literature anyway because, you know, my job. I knew that the hypothalamus connected to the pancreas. And when the hypothalamus told the pancreas what to do, the pancreas released extra insulin. And I knew that these kids had very high insulin levels. And insulin, of course, is the energy storage hormone. So I assumed that these kids were releasing insulin and the insulin was causing weight gain. So I said, well, is there anything I can do to try to stop this process? Well, there's a drug that, you know, my adult colleagues used to block growth hormone release, but it also blocks insulin release. It's called octreotide. And I had never used it before because it's mostly an adult drug. But I said, why don't we give octreotide to these kids and see what happens? And so we did a clinical research trial, you know, with IRB approval and all that, pilot study. And the most amazing thing happened. We treated 8 patients, and in the 6 months of treatment, okay, virtually every single kid lost weight. These were kids who only gained weight. But not only did they lose weight, they started being more physically active. And probably the biggest aha moment came 1 week into the first patient's trial. I told the parent, you know, hey, I've never used this drug before. I want you to give me a call in 2 weeks, and I'll see the kid in a month. The mother gives me a call in 1 week, frantic on the phone. Dr. Lustig, something's happening. And I went, oh, God, adverse event, shut the study down, go to jail. I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. Well, what happened? What happened? And the mother said to me, well, normally we would go to Taco Bell, and she would eat 5 tacos and an enchilito, and she'd still be hungry. We just went to Taco Bell, and she ate 2 tacos, and she was full, and she just vacuumed the house. I went, vacuum the house? So it was very clear to me that something was going on. And as it turns out, 4 of the 8 people in the study started being more physically active. Okay, 1 became a competitive swimmer. 2 kids started lifting weights at home. 1 kid became the manager of his high school basketball team, running around collecting all the basketballs. These were kids who sat on the couch, ate Doritos, and slept. These were kids who were lumps on a log. These were kids who, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, took their sloth and ditched it and started being physically active. And it occurred within days of starting the medication, before any weight loss had even occurred. So that was my first aha moment. And we then did a double-blind placebo-controlled trial and showed, indeed, that whenever we got the insulin down with this medicine, these patients' quality of life and their physical activity improved commensurately. And however low we got the insulin, that's how much more activity they did. I correlated. So this, to me, told me that this was proof positive that the biochemistry comes first, and the biochemistry drives the behavior. And what that told me was that all obese people, not just these kids, but all obese people, are really victims, not perpetrators. And that gave me a lot of confidence being able to go out and, you know, sort of do my job properly instead of blaming the patient. That was the first aha. The second aha occurred in 2006. So I knew that not every kid had a brain tumor. You know, every obese kid had a brain tumor. So, you know, what was going on with the other kids? Well, I learned that insulin blocked leptin. And the question was, why are these kids so insulin resistant that they're so hyperinsulinemic that their leptin's being blocked? And in 2006, I was asked by the NIH to give a guest lecture on what I thought was going on in childhood obesity today. And I, you know, it was the toxicology people at the NIH, the NIEHS, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, there in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. And so I went to their symposium, and, you know, they thought I was going to talk about, you know, some chemical in the water, you know, or bisphenol A or phthalates or, you know, organochlorines or, you know, soy estrogens or, you know, things like that. And I sat down and I thought to myself, wait a second. All right, let me think this through a different way. What are the diseases today that children get that they never got before that were adult diseases? And the answer is 2, type 2 diabetes and fatty liver disease. These are now, you know, type 2 diabetes is 1 out of every 3 kids that present with diabetes now have type 2. This was unheard of, never seen before in children. And fatty liver disease, the very first case of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease was in 1980. And now 20% of children have fatty liver disease. And 40% of obese children. So I thought to myself, this is the real epidemic. And children are getting the diseases of adulthood. They're getting the diseases of aging. and what's causing that? And I realized that those were not just the diseases of aging. They were the diseases of alcohol. Type 2 diabetes and fatty liver disease prior to 1980 were the diseases of alcohol. I said, but kids don't drink alcohol. So I opened up my biochemistry textbook, and I said, all right, let me look at alcohol metabolism, which I did. And then I said, what else are kids exposed to that follow this same pathway? And then it hit me. It was right there in the biochemistry textbook. Sugar. The specific molecule fructose. So glucose is metabolized one way. That's, you know, one component of sugar. But fructose is metabolized a different way. And I knew this back in 1975, but I had long since forgotten it. And I thought to myself, wait a second. If fructose and alcohol are metabolized the same way, and that made sense, after all, where do you get alcohol from? Fermentation of fructose is called wine. Could it be that children are getting non-alcoholic fatty liver disease because the sugar is doubling in their liver cells as alcohol? And so I put together a whole talk based on this premise, and I presented this at this meeting at the NIH. And all I can say is, after I was done, everyone in the place practically tackled me. These are toxicologists saying, oh my God, oh my God, this is right. This makes sense. You have to tell everyone about this. And I've been talking about it ever since. So I think that was my second aha moment.
Well, I did not know the statistics of type 2 diabetes in children. How young are you seeing type 2 diabetes showing up? At what age do you see?
The youngest type 2 diabetic I've seen is 5 years old.
Oh, my God. Really?
Most of them are teenagers, but the youngest one I've seen is 5 years old.
And fatty liver disease. What age is that showing up?
Oh, we can see fatty liver disease sometimes as early as age 2 or 3. It's pretty remarkable. And you know, the question is, you know, what are they eating? Well, they're always consuming enormous amounts of sugar. That's the key. That's the common denominator. So the point is that obesity is not the cause of these diseases, which is what, you know, regular doctors will tell you. You know, if you only lose weight, you know, you'd get better. Okay, it turns out obesity is a marker for the problem. It's not the cause of the problem. 20% of obese people are perfectly healthy. They will live a completely normal life, die at a completely normal age, not cost the taxpayer a dime. They're just fat. They even have normal length telomeres, the edges of the chromosomes, which determine whether or not the chromosomes unravel and whether the cell dies and therefore whether you die. All right? They have normal telomeres. They are metabolically healthy. We have a name for these people, MHO, metabolically healthy obese. We study them to try to figure out how come they didn't get sick. Conversely, 40% of the normal weight population have the exact same diseases as do the obese. Normal weight people get type 2 diabetes, hypertension, lipid problems, cardiovascular disease, cancer, dementia, polycystic ovarian disease, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease too. Now, they get it at a lower BMI. All right? Now, they get it at a lower frequency too. That, you know, 40% versus 80%. And I understand, you know, that obesity is a risk factor. But if some obese people don't get it and some normal weight people do, then how can it be about obesity?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this actually doesn't look like behavior. This looks like exposure. This looks like cholera or tuberculosis or influenza or COVID-19 for that matter. Okay, where some people get it and some people don't. So that, to me, said that obesity is a red herring. Obesity is not the issue. Metabolic health is the issue. And the question is, what's screwing our metabolic health? And that's where sugar comes in.
So we are living in unprecedented times because we have never been so inundated with foods that end up being metabolized as sugar in our body right now, ever in the history of humanity.
That's true, but it's not just the added sugar. I mean, that is definitely one thing. Okay, what I've realized, and the reason I had to write this new book, Metabolical, is that we've gotten this concept of healthy all wrong. First of all, what's the definition of healthy? There is none. All right? The FDA has a definition which is completely useless. It's basically low unsaturated fat, has a certain requisite amount of vitamin D, and has some potassium and magnesium. Really? That's healthy? The USDA doesn't even define healthy. And the reason is because if they define healthy, then all of the packaged food products in the store wouldn't be able to say healthy on their label because none of them would meet it. So they very specifically don't define it so that the food industry can use it indiscriminately. Because remember that the USDA is just, you know, the political arm of the food industry. So it's really important to have a definition of what is healthy, both for the consumer and for the industry. And so in Metabolical, in this book, I define what is healthy based on the empiric science. And I can sum it up, the answer, in six words. Two clauses, six words. And you can write these down or you can memorize them. But this is what healthy is. One, protect the liver. Two, feed the gut. Protect the liver, feed the gut. Any food that does both is healthy. Any food that does neither is poison. And any food that does one or the other but not both is somewhere in the middle. And that's actually what the empiric data show. That is actually validated by, you know, what we know about, you know, certain, you know, consumption of certain foods and morbidity and mortality. And there's a reason why those two things are sort of the standouts. Protect the liver, feed the gut. You know, so the question is, protect the liver from what? Well, protect it from the tsunami of mono and disaccharides, you know, sugars that are basically being absorbed too early in the intestine. Normally, in the old days, sugars would be absorbed in the jejunum. Now they're being absorbed in the duodenum. And the reason is because there's no fiber. So the sugars basically get from the duodenum straight via the bloodstream to the liver, overwhelm the liver's capacity to be able to metabolize them. The liver has no choice but to take the excess and divert it to a pathway to make liver fat. This is a process called de novo lipogenesis, new fat making. This is how your liver turns sugar into fat. And this is where the fatty liver comes from. And once your liver starts to store fat, now the liver's not working right. Now the pancreas has to make extra insulin to make the liver do its job. So now you've got high insulin levels all over the body. And that's driving both weight gain and also chronic metabolic disease, such as coronary artery growth and hardening, cancer cell development, etc. All right, so protect the liver. Also, feed the gut. Now, people say, you know, when they're pregnant, I'm eating for two. Well, you know what? We're always eating for 100 trillion because there are 10 trillion cells in your body, but there are 100 trillion bacteria in your intestine. All right? They outnumber us 10 to 1. Well, what do they eat? They have to survive. What do they eat? Well, they eat what you eat. The question is, how much did you get versus how much did they get? And it turns out when you eat food without fiber, you're starving them because that was their food. You've taken it out because you've eaten ultra-processed food, which is fiberless food. That fiber was for them, and they had it all these years, but now they don't. And so what happens when you starve bacteria in your gut? Okay, if you don't feed your bacteria will feed on you. It will actually strip the mucin layer right off your intestinal epithelial cells. And that will lead to denuding of your intestine, which will lead to apposition of bacteria right on your intestinal cells, which will then lead to leaky gut and transfer of lipopolysaccharides and cytokines and full bacteria for that matter into the bloodstream, which will lead to systemic inflammation, which then basically puts the exclamation point on chronic metabolic disease. So you have to feed your gut. Protect the liver, feed the gut. Real food does both. Processed food does neither. Because real food is low sugar, high fiber. Processed food is high sugar, low fiber. And that's the difference. And that's why processed food is poison.
Are we seeing, in addition to this non-alcoholic fatty liver, are we seeing fatty liver accumulating in other organs like the heart?
Oh, yes.
Like,
sure. Yes. We're seeing fat in all, virtually all organs, muscle, heart, pancreas. We've actually got a paper coming out shortly about non-alcoholic fatty pancreas disease. It's happening in many tissues. When it happens in the pancreas, it reduces insulin release. When it happens in the liver, it induces insulin resistance. And it is the combination of the two that leads to type 2 diabetes. So,
and then
you
have
this
leptin resistance. Going back to the leptin,
right,
where you don't get the signal that you're full, so
right,
you are always hungry, which leads
correct
to this vicious cycle.
Exactly right. That is the vicious cycle. So insulin blocks leptin, as we talked about before. And it makes sense that insulin should block leptin, because after all, if your leptin worked right all the time, if it always worked correctly, you could never gain weight. You could never go through puberty. You could never go through pregnancy. There are two times in your life when you actually have to have leptin blocked, puberty and pregnancy. And you need both for survival of the species. So doesn't it make sense that the same hormone that causes the weight gain should be the same hormone that acts on the brain to tell you to keep eating so that you can gain the weight? So that's, but the point is you're only supposed to be insulin resistant twice in your life. We're insulin resistant 24/7, 365. And the reason is sugar.
And I just want to go back to this, you know, these children that are diagnosed as type 2 diabetes. If you're diagnosed, you know, I've had family members who, because of their food choices primarily, were diagnosed with diabetes and then went down the long, winding road of falling apart, blindness, amputations, and heart attacks.
Indeed.
It's just heartbreaking, right? That's why diabetes is so horrible. It's not a quick death. And
no.
if these children or teenagers are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, what is the prognosis for their life?
Well,
lifespan.
So the question is type 2 diabetes reversible? And the answer is, yes, it is. Now, doctors won't tell you that. The pharma industry won't tell you that. But in fact, if you catch it within the first 7 years, you can reverse type 2 diabetes. After a while, you get to the point where the beta cells just can't work at all and, you know, can't multiply again. But initially, it looks like you can actually rescue your beta cells and be able to make insulin. But in order to do so, you're going to have to stop the insulin resistance. You're going to have to get metabolically healthy. And you're going to have to let your liver and your pancreas heal. There is a company called Virta Health, and I'm not here to, you know, stump for them, but what they mm-hmm. have done is they have reversed 80% of the patients who go on their program by instituting a ketogenic diet, a high-fat, mm-hmm. low-carbohydrate diet that induces ketones. And the reason is because that allows the liver to burn off the liver fat. That allows the pancreas to get rid of the fatty pancreas and allows those beta cells in the pancreas to start working again. And so you can reverse type 2 diabetes mm-hmm. if you catch it early enough. The longer you wait, the less chance that'll happen. So these kids today who are on their way to type 2 diabetes, who are already pre-diabetic, they can turn themselves around. Now, the question is, ketogenic diet is really hard. You have to be really fastidious. You have to stay on it. You know, the minute you go off it, you have stopped the ketogenesis, because as soon as you've got an insulin spike, that's the end of your ketones. So it's really, really hard to do, especially with our current food environment. So the question that we want to answer is, does everyone have to be that extreme? Could you just get rid of added sugar and do just as well? And the answer to that is, we don't know the full answer to that yet, but for many people, just getting rid of sugar seems to do just as well. Maybe the, you know, most severe cases would need a ketogenic diet. But the bottom line is, virtually anyone and everyone can reverse their metabolic dysfunction. And we've shown that we can do it in kids as quickly as 9 days. And my colleagues have shown in adults they can do it as quickly as 2 weeks. But you got to eat right. And right now, people are not eating right.
So let's just talk a moment about sugar. Sugar, when we talk about sugar, we're talking about sodas. We're talking about cookies, candies.
We're talking about salad dressing. We're talking about yogurt. We're talking about hamburger buns. We're talking about virtually everything in the store that has a label, because that's where the sugar is. 37% of the sugar in our diet is in soft drinks, and we know about those. 16% of the sugar in our diet is in things we normally associate with dessert, candy, cake, cookies, ice cream. That means that 50% of the added sugar in our diet is in foods we didn't know had them. Ketchup, barbecue sauce, hamburger buns, hamburger meat, salad dressing, yogurt, et cetera, et cetera. All right? So bottom line, all of those are ultra-processed food, very specifically, and that's the problem. And it's the ultra-processed food that is driving this phenomenon, both because of the added sugar and because of the deletion of fiber.
Well, I think that's part of the revelation in this conversation, just how pervasive sugar is and how it is hidden in everything that's processed.
Well, and it's on purpose, because the food industry knows that when they add it, you buy more. That's their gravy train. That's their juggernaut. And we know that because of an economic principle, which maybe your audience will have heard of. It's called price elasticity. So price elasticity is an economic term, okay, but it basically tells you about addiction. So price elasticity asks the question, how will the consumption of a food change if the price of the food goes up? Now, if the price of the food goes up, consumption should go down, because of, free market economy and, supply and demand. So basically what you're doing when you raise the price is you're reducing effective availability. That should reduce consumption. The question is how much. And there are price elastic items, and there are price inelastic items. So an example of a price elastic item would be eggs, right? So when the price of eggs go up, people stop eating eggs. That's price elastic. Mm-hmm. There are three foods in particular that are price inelastic. That is, the price will go up and people still consume them anyway, at just virtually at the exact same level. And those three foods are fast food, soft drinks, and juice. So what do those three items have in common?
Sugar.
There you go. Because sugar is hedonic, sugar stimulates the reward center. Sugar stimulates dopamine release at the level of the nucleus accumbens, the reward center of the brain. And basically, anything that's hedonic is price inelastic. You will pay extra for it because you need your fix.
Yeah. Because it is an addiction. It is an
addiction. Because it is an addiction. Because it is an addiction. Exactly right.
Well, what a racket, huh? Look how
well they could have put cocaine
all
in the food.
Made into addicts. Yeah.
Yeah, they could have put cocaine in the food, and once upon a time, you know, Coca-Cola did have cocaine. But, you know, it turns out sugar and caffeine do just as well.
Well, sad. So we've been captured by the by everyone. We've been captured by the food industry. We've been captured by the USDA. We've been captured probably by the FDA. I mean, we've been captured by everybody, right, to generate.
Well, and that's because the USDA is captured by the food industry and the FDA is captured by the drug industry. These are known as elite capture. These are captured agencies. If you look at who runs either of those two departments, it's always somebody from the private sector who goes back to the private sector when they're done. So there's a revolving door. And so these two agencies are not working in the populace's best interest. And that's another reason I wrote the book, is to expose exactly what's going on at the USDA and the FDA.
You know, when you lay this out, and I want us to go into the strategies that you think are most effective to help people withdraw and to make the best choices for their health. But when we lay it out, you know, as it is, we have been the fodder that, you know, maybe the world, but certainly our culture and here in the West, we've been the fodder to generate profits. We've been fodder to generate profits. We've been fodder to generate profits because we have been addicted. Food has been created so we could be addictive. So we have to have these foods that create all the metabolic diseases that are plaguing our society. And then the drug companies can give us all of these medications to, they don't cure,
well,
but to manage us. And here we are. We're just
so the question,
grist
the question
for their
is,
mill.
Is this a conspiracy? The question is this a conspiracy? And the answer is we don't know. Is it, you know, that the food industry and the pharma industry are working in cahoots with each other so that the food industry makes us sick so the pharma industry can clean up? We don't know. However, having said that, we do know that Nestle is now making Butterfingers and diabetes pills.
I think we're gathering a lot of evidence. I think you have to be, you know, I probably correct me when you talk about this, not necessarily when I talk about it, but it's a blinding flash of the obvious. It's a blinding flash of the obvious. Because
well,
when there's so,
well, there
so much opposition to put healthy food into school, when that becomes a political football, we know we have forces at work.
Exactly. And I'm actually the chief science officer of a nonprofit dedicated to getting real food into schools around the country called Eat Real. Your listeners can find it at eatreal.org. And very specifically, we have a paradigm that can basically get schools the food they need and actually save money doing it.
Yeah. There was a program in Appleton, Wisconsin that I read about many years ago in a book. Do you know about that school?
Not sure.
Where
Not sure.
They, this was a school where they would put kids who were, you know, troublemakers, disruptive, poor learners. They would all go into the school. And they decided that they were going to change the diet, clean up the diet, put exercise machines in the back of the classrooms. And in a short amount of time, these kids turned totally around. They became model students. They became great learners. They just had amazing, no more behavioral problems. They were happy. Mm-hmm. It was profound.
Well,
profound.
So I don't know about that school in particular. I would like to know about it. In fact, a colleague of mine, an Israeli entrepreneur, relatively rich guy named Yossi Vardi, did this with district of Ramallah on the West Bank. They had a 27% graduation rate from high school. He took over the schools and he did one thing. He didn't change the teachers. He didn't change the curriculum. He didn't change anything. All he did was he gave them breakfast. That's all he did. And it was a real breakfast. Right? And they went from a 27% graduation rate to a 95% graduation rate in 2 years.
Wow. You know,
food matters.
Potential that it's being lost. Yeah. Oh.
Food matters, and the problem is real food is health, and processed food is disease. And people think processed food is food. It's not. It's poison. And people need to understand the difference, and they have to understand the molecular mechanisms by which this occurs. And when they do, then they won't go back. And this is the reason I wrote the book, is to make this, you know, shall we say, apparent.
Okay, well, wait, that's what we're going to move to next. But I just have one sad comment to make. I've seen people, type 2 diabetics, they get into, you know, their blood sugar goes down. And what do they do? What do they reach for? Candy bar?
Candy or juice Coke. Or whatever. That's right.
I see that, and I just want to cry. Mm-hmm. I just want to cry. Yep. It's like, no, that is the wrong food. You know, go for some protein. You know, really help to stabilize your blood sugar. And wherever they have been given that information, it's killing them. Oh, my God.
Well, the dietitians are, you know, basically telling people, well, you can't be hypoglycemic, and the best way to turn that around is with juice. And they do this, you know, at University of California, San Francisco. You know, and I've had more than my share of arguments with dietitians over exactly this issue. The fact of the matter is UCSF was able in 2015 to institute what we call the Healthy Beverage Initiative. We got rid of soft drinks from the entire campus. All venues at UCSF are now soda-free. I mean, you can get diet soda, but sugar beverages are not allowed on campus from any vendor. Now, if you want to bring a sugared soda from home, you can, but you can't buy it on the campus. Now, what's interesting is we studied this. We actually, you know, when it went into effect, we studied 214 of the employees and showed that their insulin sensitivity improved and their waist circumference went down over the course of the 10 months as their sugar beverage consumption got cut in half. So they went from 35 ounces a day to 18 ounces per day, and in the process lost waist circumference and improved metabolic health, and, you know, improved fasting insulin, which is great, except that we couldn't get rid of juice. And the reason was because the dietitians thought that getting rid of juice was, quote, cruel and inhuman punishment.
Yeah. Well, they've been trained well.
Maybe it's because they needed the juice.
Yeah. I remember when I was lecturing in Australia, because I go back and forth to Australia for decades now, and I learned that the pediatric society or association, whatever it was funded by Coca-Cola. So,
right. Absolutely. Oh, in 2009, I was the keynote speaker at the American Academy of Pediatrics meeting in Washington, D.C. In fact, in the green room, I met Attorney General Eric Holder. That was a highlight of my career. But what was interesting about that was I was talking about sugar and chronic disease, and I had a slide in my slide deck which said that the opening ceremonies of that same meeting were sponsored by Coca-Cola. And And the executive director of the American Academy of Pediatrics came into the green room and said, Dr. Lustig, we've reviewed your slides, and you cannot go on to the podium unless you remove that slide.
Were you able to say it?
No, they told me basically I could not say it. I could not show it. I could not say it. So I'm telling you now.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah. what a challenge you've taken on. Thank goodness. You know, just
so
a hero's journey here.
It is a challenge. I won't argue. Yeah. It is a challenge.
Yeah, you're probably enemy number one for many of these departments, these government organizations. But good, you're staying in for the fight. So let's talk about what would help all of us to be healthier. And I want to, you know, as we're talking about these conditions, it just brings to mind, because I do work with women, this will. So many health issues for women are related to sugar, but, you know, this epidemic of PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, that's going on, because it's not only causes so many symptoms in women, but it's also causing infertility in women, which is a big problem right now.
Well, likely the cause of that infertility is insulin resistance. And when you make the ovary insulin sensitive, okay, you get more estrogen, less androgen, and start getting ovulation instead of anovulatory cycles. So it's one of the reasons metformin works sometimes, you know, to improve fertility. Bottom line is women have to be insulin sensitive, and right now they are not. They are insulin resistant. 88% of all Americans are metabolically unhealthy, according to a study from 2017. Okay, and they all have high fasting insulins. So until we fix the food, because there's no medicine for this, until we fix the food, you know, this will continue to be a problem.
Well, what do you guide us now? How do you guide us? What is it that, from what you have researched, what is the most healing approach with food that we should all, at 88%, of our population, we're talking about everybody, really needs to hear this.
To be honest with you, Cheryl, it's very simple. Eat what came out of the ground, or eat the animals that ate what came out of the ground. The way to know is very simple. If a food has a label, it's a warning label.
Mm-hmm.
Real food doesn't need a label because nothing's been done to it. Every food that has a label means that in some fashion that food has been processed, or it would need the label. So the question is, what's been done to the food? Now, unfortunately, currently our food label only tells us what's in the food. It doesn't tell us what's been done to the food. So the food label is completely inadequate for being able to tell us what we should be eating, which of course is why things are not getting better. And I anticipate they still will not get better until the food industry starts doing the right thing, which is why I wrote the book, is to basically point out to them what is going wrong and why they have to change. Now, they're going to drive this bus till the wheels fall off. The only way to get the food industry to listen is to educate the public. And the public has to understand that they get to vote. In fact, they vote 21 times a week. And when they vote, and they vote properly, you know, then the problem will get fixed. And that's why education is so important.
And what do you recommend to people who either are aware or are becoming aware that they have a sugar addiction? How do people wean off of that addiction? What have you found to be effective?
Right. So first of all, think of it this way. Okay, we have addictive substances. We have cocaine, very addictive. We have heroin, very addictive. We have nicotine, pretty darn addictive, not quite as addictive as the other two. Okay, we have alcohol. Now, alcohol is an interesting case. All right, because 40% of Americans are teetotalers, don't touch the stuff. 40% are social drinkers, can pick up a beer, put it down, no problem. I'm in that category. 10% are binge drinkers, and 10% are hardcore alcoholics. That's what the data show. Now, what distinguishes a social drinker from a binge drinker? No one knows. The bottom line is that even though there's alcohol there, not everyone's addicted. Probably same for sugar, because sugar and alcohol are virtually identical. They're metabolized identically, as we talked about earlier. So there are a lot of people in this world who go through it, and you know, they'll tell you, they'll go right up to you and say, oh, I have a horrible sweet tooth. Because that's still socially acceptable. Now, if they came up to you and said, oh, I have a horrible alcohol problem, you would look at them a little cross-eyed. You know, that's not very socially acceptable. If they came up to you and said, oh, I have a horrible cocaine addiction, you know, that's also not socially acceptable. Okay? But to say to somebody, I have a horrible sweet tooth, you know, there are a lot of people who say that. That's sugar addiction. And likely, the reason they're telling you that is because they're looking for a, you know, an enabler, a, you know, a co-conspirator, so they can go indulge and not feel bad about it. Ultimately, someday, we have to get to the point where that is, where saying that is as socially unacceptable as it is for alcohol or for, you know, heroin or cocaine. So that's going to take a long time because people don't understand that, that, you know, sugar is addictive. But what it also says is that not everybody is affected equally. So some people can consume a little bit of sugar and it would be okay. Point is, sugar should be safe and rare. And yeah, right now it's in everything. And as long as it's in our salad dressing, as long as it's in our barbecue sauce, as long as it's in our hamburger buns and hamburger meat, don't expect this to get better. People have to, you know, basically search for real food, because if the food's been processed, it virtually means, you know, it's almost an automatic that sugar's been added to it. And the reason the sugar's been added to it is because it's addictive, because that's the food industry's hook. That's their juggernaut. That's their gravy train. That's how they figured out that, that when they add it, you buy more. So what's going to protect you from that? Well, education can start, but ultimately, you know, changes at the food policy level have to occur. And that's what I'm, you know, working towards.
There are sugars or sweeteners on the market now. There's xylitol, there is monk fruit, there's, you know, various things. But what are your thoughts about them as alternatives?
Well, so there was a paper in the European Journal of Nutrition that was in a meta-analysis looking at all the different artificial sweeteners. And basically, I can sum it up in one sentence. The toxicity of one Coca-Cola equals the toxicity of two Diet Coca-Colas. So, better, but not good. Okay? Still toxic. You just need double the amount to be as toxic. And that sort of makes sense. Now, you say, wait a second, there's no fructose. There's no calories. How can a diet soda be toxic? And the answer is because it's still causing insulin release. We now have the data to demonstrate how and why it's still causing insulin release. You put something sweet on the tongue, you still get insulin release. Mm-hmm. And that insulin still drives weight gain, and it still drives chronic metabolic disease. Now, it is true that diet sweeteners don't generate as much insulin as sugar does, but it still drives it. And as long as it drives it, it's still an issue.
Wow. I was on a protocol for a while where I was doing intermittent fasting. I was calorie restriction, cut out all carbs, and had just, you know, organic meats and some fats. And, you know, occasionally I used to have a little dark chocolate here and there. That was like my little treat. Mm-hmm. And when I went on that protocol, I actually lost all interest in sugar, period.
Yeah.
Which
I'll
is...
bet.
which was like a blessing, right? I have no interest in sweets. Mm-hmm. I have no interest in dark chocolate. I just don't crave it. They're just not a part of my life anymore, which is
it takes time, a
relief.
So what we've learned is that it takes about 5 days. About 5 days. Just like any other addiction. And in those 5 days, you're going to have all the symptoms of withdrawal. You're going to be jittery. You're going to be anxious. You're going to be tired. You're going to be fatigued. You might even have some brain fog. You know, it's not as bad as heroin. I mean, you're not hanging from the rafters, but it is, you know, you get symptoms that are consistent with withdrawal. And it takes about 5 days for those to start dissipating and for them those to start going away. The problem is if you don't know that to expect them because you don't know that sugar is addictive and you try to do that on your own without the knowledge, then as soon as you start experiencing those symptoms, you're going to go right back. And that's the recidivism of sugar consumption. So, you know, we basically need to adopt the addiction paradigm in terms of getting people off processed food.
Well, it's such a wake up call what you're sharing with us, and it's a shock, and I hope people are shocked by these statistics and the realization of how much our food sources have been captured, and what it is has done to us, what it's doing to our children, probably doing to our future generations, and we really need to wake up. And realize we need to reclaim our health, reclaim our freedom, reclaim our power to make the choices that are going to support us. And this is what your work is. This is why it's so important, Rob. It's so profound what you are doing. And I have no doubt, we didn't even get there, the opposition I am sure you have gotten and continue to get because, you're such a rebel to the system. And we are also grateful to you.
Hey, I'm just doing my job.
You're doing just such a stellar job. And thank you. Thank you for taking on this mission. And I want people to pick up a copy of Dr. Robert Lutzig's new book, Metabolical, The Lure and the Lies of Processed Food, Nutrition, and Modern Medicine. If you want to get healthy, if you want to support your family, if you want to get empowered, get this knowledge. The website is the best website. Your name, Robert Lustig, LUSTIG.com. People can learn more there. And is that good? Is that the best website?
RobertLustig.com is for me. Metabolical.com is for the book. If you want to buy the book online, there's Amazon and Barnes & Noble and probably some other booksellers, Kobo, et cetera. I prefer people buy the book at bookstores. We need to support our local bookstores. Bookstores are happiness. We do not want them to go away.
I absolutely agree. So thank you so much for your time, so much for your compassion towards humanity and the work you're doing. Thank you so much, Dr. Robert Lutzig, for being with us today.
My pleasure, Cheryl. Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. And thank you, all of my listeners who are part of my community. Please come back, keep learning, keep growing, keep getting empowered with truthful information. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.